tiny in all that air. The Philip Larkin Society Podcast.
Hello and welcome to Tiny in All That Air, the Philip Larkin Society podcast. My name is Lynn Lockwood and I'm one of the Society Trustees. One of our charitable aims is to promote the appreciation of Larkin's contemporaries. Larkin was just 5 years old when Thomas Hardy died in 1928, but this English poet and novelist was going to have a profound influence on Philip Larkin's writing. To discuss some of the connections between Larkin and Hardy, I'm joined by two fantastic guests, Emeritus Professor of English at the University of Hull, Jane Thomas, and composer Arthur Keegan.
Jane Thomas, I'm Emeritus Professor of English at the University of Hull. My research specialisms centre on Thomas Hardy, and I've published a couple of monographs and quite a lot of essays on Hardy. First got interested in Hardy at university with Professor Marion Shaw, and she taught us, I think, in our first year, and she introduced me to Hardy's poems, and I just remember that lecture as being quite a kind of important moment. With Larkin, I got interested in Larkin when I met him, actually, strangely enough.
Lovely. That's amazing.
I've put this on the Larkin Society website, that I asked him to sign a copy of his poems for my mother, because we'd recently lost my dad. And he came over to my research room in Salmon Grove and knocked on the door and asked me if I was the person who'd sent him this book to sign. I was a bit frightened and said, well, yeah, I am. And he said, I don't sign books for people I don't know. And I said, that's fine. And then he saw all the books on Hardy, because I was writing my PhD. And we had this conversation about Hardy, but which we disagreed on a few things. And then he disappeared. And then a porter came over with the signed book for my mother and a signed book for me of A Girl in Winter. So that was quite an indelible moment. And
that's such a generous thing to do.
Absolutely. Yeah.
How was the disagreement? I can't imagine arguing with Larkin.
Well, he'd written this essay called Wanted a Good Hardy Critic, and he was finding most of the critics that I was working with not fitting that bill, and one in particular that I was quite keen on, Roy Morell, who was arguing very strongly against Hardy's pessimism, saying basically he's not a pessimist, he's a meliorist, he just, he uses experience, if you like, negative experience in a philosophical way towards his own meliorism. And Larkin didn't agree with that at all. And he just slated Morell's book in a review. And he'd slated it in this Wanted a Good Hardy Critic article he'd written for the Critical Quarterly. So we talked mainly about that. Looking at that article again, I kind of realised that we're sort of coming from a similar direction, but from coming from different directions to roughly the same place.
Oh, that's interesting.
Just putting the two together, if you put Hardy and Larkin together in relation to that idea of whether or not they're miserable, whether or not Hardy's pessimist, they're working from the same hymn sheet, as it were, singing from the same hymn sheet in many ways, but not quite in the way that I naively thought at the time with Hardy.
I'm keen on Hardy not being a pessimist. I kind of read quite a lot of positivity, even though it's through the lens of death and decay and time. It's kind of, whilst talking about death, saying how great life is to me.
Yeah.
What's meliorist? I beg your pardon, it's probably something I really should know.
Yeah, well, it's the idea that things are gradually getting better. Hardy has a quite complicated philosophy about the imminent will being unheeding, really. It's just a kind of force that governs the universe. But that human beings have, by accident, become conscious and become emotional and able to rail against the injustices of this indifferent will that seems to be the ruling power of the universe. And Hardy's idea was that the more conscious human beings become of suffering and ways to ameliorate suffering, the more that we will inform this unconscious will that rules the universe. He calls it consciousness, the will informing, till it fashion all things fair. And he sees poetry as absolutely fundamental in doing that, in generating empathy and sympathy and communication. He says, and I think Larkin's got a very similar idea of what the role of art is and what the role of a poet is. Mm. It's a very vocational role, that it's your role to recognise suffering in ordinary everyday circumstances, like the hedgehog and the mower. You recognise these moments. They're not always moments of misery. They can be moments of ecstasy, moments of joy. And because you have the consciousness to recognise that, then you therefore have a duty, because you notice that, if we're going to talk about afterwards, maybe later, because you're a person who notices those things. It's therefore your duty to use your art in the best way you possibly can to communicate that sensation, that feeling. Larkin has this idea that people from different cultures should be able to recognise that emotion that you're actually trying to communicate in your poetry. It doesn't matter where you're from, what gender you are, what your sexual orientation is, or whether, you know, if this poem works, it's going to cut across all of that and speak to anybody at any time.
In a world that doesn't have a god there.
Well, he was a committed scholar of religion, I think, treading into highly expert territory, which I'm not. But he was very well read, very considered on religion, and just over time whittled away. I mean, it's the same story that happens in Jude, Jude the Obscure. It's and Emma, his wife, turned ever more religious, and this is part of their difficulty in their marriage.
He never lost the emotional connection with the church. But he did lose a belief in the kind of more esoteric trappings, really, and oddishness and all of that. But the actual emotional idea behind Christianity was something that he never lost.
I was listening to Philip Larkin's Desert Island Discs earlier on today. It's just so lovely to listen to. And when he was talking about what I'd need some music to listen to on a Sunday, and he chooses Thomas Tallis, and he says, you know, I'm still quite a churchy kind of person, you know, and the love of the churches and the buildings and some of a lot of the aspects around it, but not having the kind of religious faith within it. You know, church going is the great poem of that, isn't it? Where he can see into the future in a way that Thomas Hardy isn't able to at that point, but Larkin sort of projects into the future what we might end up doing with these churches, and where religion might end up. It's really, really fascinating.
There's definitely a connection with the kind of architecture, the stuff of religion, including the ritual and the music that Hardy responds to very strongly. And certainly his kind of politics or libertarianism to a degree does look to the future of religion. You know, the way that it's adapted over the last 70 years feels very prescient to me in Hardy's understanding of church and religion.
Arthur, you haven't introduced yourself yet.
Sorry, no.
We've got gone stuck straight in really quickly.
Well, I'm Arthur Keegan. I'm a composer, and at the moment I'm working on a project that we're cautiously titling Wessex Songs. And this is a collaboration that we started in 2018 with the mezzo-soprano Lottie Betz-Dean. It all started from a Hardy perspective, and then I kind of dragged Larkin into it. So our Hardy premise is that we've got a cycle of songs that set some of the poems of 1912 to 1913 that Hardy wrote just after the death of Emma Gifford, his first wife. And that cycle is called Elegies for Emma. And then I had an opportunity to write a string quartet with voice, which became a sister piece to that, which is called Elegies for Tom. And that one is a response to Hardy's poem Afterwards. But mixed into that is Larkin's poem The Mower, which is set as interludes between each of the movements of the quartet. Larkin's poem The Mower riffs entirely on Hardy's Afterwards, both in subject matter and actual kind of content of the hedgehog, the idea of the hedgehog. So they work really nicely together. But I mean, I came to poetry extremely late, and my first experience with Hardy at all was at school, and you know, I wasn't a particularly good student, but Reading Far From the Madding Crowned was definitely the worst and most boring experience of my life as a 16-year-old. But fortunately, I've kind of grown up. And
I was wasted on the young.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. It's not a young person's game.
First one I read when I was about 14, and our English teacher always used to call it Far From. So we'd always be saying to each other, oh, is it Far From today? But then we did Mary Casterbridge for GCSE, and then, well, O-level, and then we did Jude the Obscure for A-level. And by that point, I was very entrenched and really loved it.
Well, I hadn't really come across any of Hardy poems until maybe getting into Finzi's settings of Hardy when I was in my early 20s. I had a very dear friend who's actually gave me this collected works of Hardy when I started this project, who, you know, just loves Finzi and Hardy. And it's kind of from that point that I started to get into it. I mean, it's all the more ironic because I was born, I grew up about 2 minute walk from where Larkin was born in Coventry.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's literally just around the corner. We finally had a blue pack put up last year, and I went and visited when I was up there last Christmas. And yeah, it's literally, I don't know, 90-second walk from my house.
Oh, fantastic. The kind of narrative about Philip Larkin and Hardy is that Hardy set Philip Larkin free from writing like WBA, and the young Larkin was writing much more in a more kind of ethereal, mystical way, The North Ship. And then the idea was he picked up chosen poems of Thomas Hardy, the Hardy collection that Hardy put together himself, and decided, no, I could just write about everyday things. It's quite a sort of simple idea, but I think a lot of people find that quite a useful way into looking at Hardy and Larkin and starting to understand like how they work together. I was reading James Underwood's really excellent research, early Larkin, and he puts forward the idea that actually it's probably not nuanced enough, that interpretation, and so many other things were going on with Larkin at the time, and all the experimentation he'd done as Brunette Coleman, for example, was already leading him to very different places.
My only connection with that is that didn't he want to be a novelist, and Hardy always wanted to be a poet, and they kind of ended up somewhat switched.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? And the fact that Hardy was about, when Hardy turned back to poetry, or turned, you know, after he'd turned his back on writing novels, he was about the age where Larkin had had enough entirely of writing. And the energy that Hardy must have had, because he wrote huge amount of poetry, didn't he, in that second half of his life.
His last volume was posthumously published. Winter Words was published after he died. So
There can't be a poet who has 70% of their output post-60. I can't think of many others who would fit into that. And Hardy's long life, it kind of skews people's perception of Hardy, because whenever I tell people he died in 1928, they're always shocked. He's really thought of as a Victorian through and through. But, you know, 1928, it says a lot about it. It makes you understand his writing in a slightly different way, I think.
I mean, he's very rarely included properly in like anthologies of war poetry, but he wrote a lot of war poetry. I mean, he wrote the Boer War, and he's even written quite a few about the Napoleonic Wars. But, you know, he wrote some, like Drummer Hodge is an incredibly moving poem. That sometimes is anthologized. But he also wrote First World War poems as well. Mm. In terms of the balance of novels and poetry, you could look to Lawrence, but then, you know, Lawrence was probably dead by his early 30s, mid-30s.
There's connections here. I mean, one of the things we're hoping to do next year with the album of all this music that we've kind of collected from over the last 100 years, plus the new pieces, we're hoping to do a walk from Bristol down to Dorchester, staging concerts along the way.
Oh,
and that follows in the footsteps of Gustav Holst, who did that exact journey. Yeah. We certainly won't be doing it as quickly as he did. He was an amazing walker. But the connection there is that Holst was hugely interested in Buddhism and was extremely well-read. And when Hardy was started going to London, he was mixing with the Theosophist Society, and just so many people visited Maxgate from across such a wide strata of society, and with such interesting and different ideas. It's one of the things that makes Hardy such an interesting character, I think, and able to talk about such a wide range of things, and I mean, I'm speculating, but Larkin's response to Hardy has got to be to do with that kind of complexity. Hardy's able to talk about everyday moments with such a broad weight of experience and history and knowledge.
Mm. He was so incredibly well read in a way that I think, you know, only the Victorians could be. If you look at his two volumes of literary notebooks where he's copying out by hand or cutting and pasting quotations, I mean, the range of his reading is absolutely phenomenal. And he's not alone there for the time, and I'm sure he's not alone there for the writers in this day and age. But he was incredibly intellectually curious and really, really well read. And, you know, he went through Mill and Compton, Huxley and Spencer and Darwin, and then...
He developed his learning of Greek and Latin as a young schoolboy. He learnt it at school, but he continued to study it, didn't he, himself?
Yeah, Sappho, he was one of the earliest, you know, readers of Sappho. Wharton's translation of Sappho he read. If you start talking about the poets and capacious knowledge that he has that informs it. But, I mean, you know, it's like if you go back to your coupling of the mower and afterwards. It's this idea that you can take a small thing like the Dewfall Hall or the bell or the hedgehog crossing comfortably across the lawn, or in Larkin's case, the hedgehog jammed up against the mower, and it can seem like just an ordinary everyday thing, but in both of those cases, those instances become deeply freighted with significance.
Jane, would you be able to read afterwards, or Arthur? I don't mind. It might be nice maybe if we have afterwards in the mower and we could read them.
Yeah.
Would that be okay? You're right to read the mower, Arthur.
With afterwards, I like the idea of a pun, that it's afterwards, but it's also after words as well.
Oh, yeah.
Talking about the end of his life, but also the end of his time as a poet. It's like, what will my life mean to other people? What will they think about me? But also, what will my poetry mean? What will all the words I've written mean as well?
Yeah.
I think it comes back to that thing we started with, that they were both men who used to notice things.
And he was in his 70s when he wrote this, wasn't he?
You're probably right.
Yeah. I think it was published in 1917, so kind of around there.
Yeah. This is one that I was thinking about. The language of death is so rich in Hardy, and I love the my bell of quittance and I've been stilled at last. There's such really poignant sort of imagery and such rich language that he uses.
But also the idea that people, I suppose everybody thinks this really, that people coming on afterwards might stand in that very same spot that he stood in, and of course Hardy pilgrims do this all the time. You know, they like to go in through the front door of Max Gate, and they, you know, they like to go to the specific bit in Cornwall where Emma lost the picnic, you know, beaker and fertile land, see if they can find it. And he's already sort of anticipating that idea of, I suppose, fame in a way, you think?
Yeah, it is a poem about legacy, isn't it?
Exactly. What's his legacy? So afterwards, so after his life, but also if you think of the poem, afterwards. When the present has latched its postern behind my tremulous stay, and the May month flaps its glad green leaves like wings, delicate filmed as new spun silk, will the neighbours say, he was a man who used to notice such things? If it be in the dusk, when, like an eyelid's soundless blink, the dewfall hawk comes crossing the shades to alight upon the wind-warped upland thorn, a gazer might think, to him, this must have been a familiar sight. If I pass during some nocturnal blackness, mothy and warm, when the hedgehog travels furtively over the lawn, one may say, he strove that such innocent creatures should come to no harm, but he could do little for them, and now he's gone. If, when hearing that I have been stilled at last, they stand at the door, watching the full-starred heavens that winter sees, will this thought rise on those who will meet my face no more? He was one who had an eye for such mysteries. And will any say, when my bell of quittance is heard in the gloom, and a crossing breeze cuts a pause in its outrollings, till they rise again, as they were in new bells' boom, he hears it not now, but used to notice such things.
Wonderful.
And it is that thing about the Onapapim thorn, as you will know from your setting of the voice, Arthur, that thorn comes back again and again, that old mild thorn with the wind going through it.
Yeah, the consistent imagery. I mean, that's one of the things that makes setting a bunch of Hardy texts wonderful. You have those little reference points that you can tie into across the music in different areas. Mm. I mean, some of the imagery in that poem is, when you take it out of context, it's really abstract. And this is one of the things that I really enjoyed about responding to this in the quartet. So the five movements of the quartet are without words. They're a musical response to this poem. Mm-hmm. The Larkin is then set as the interludes. But each movement kind of hones in on just one line from each stanza. So delicate filmed as new spun silk is the first movement. This one I found really amazing. An eyelid soundless blink. That's an incredibly abstract and poetic idea. Mm. Nocturnal blackness, mothy and warm is the third movement, the full-starred heavens, and then the final movement is a new bell's boom. And just being able to take those as a kind of starting point for a sound world was incredibly evocative. I mean, it made my job a lot easier in terms of, and it also gives you a wonderful structure because there's kind of slow movements implied by those lines as they go through and faster. Mm. But yeah, I mean, that's what struck me with afterwards when I first came across it, is that if you dissect it, there's some abstract, strange imagery, but within the context, it's just very immediate and very grabbable.
I like the pivotal hedgehog in the middle. I'm not sure how much of this is metaphorical. It feels like he wants you to see the hedgehog and the stars and the hawk. It's proper nature. It's not just metaphorical. Yeah.
Well, again, once he's noticed it and put it in a poem, if the poem works, then you notice it.
Yes.
At that point. It's like throughout these stanzas, there's the stillness of the passing of the man. I presume it's a man, the narrator isn't gendered. The stillness of the passing of the narrator contraposed against the movement. There's movement in each of these stanzas, isn't there? There's the May month, and it's tempting to say the May moth. It's the May month flaps its glad green leaves like wings. Then there's the dewfall hawk coming across the shade. Then there's the hedgehog, as you say, travelling furtively. And then the stars, I suppose they do move, don't they? But imperceptibly.
Yeah.
You hear the bell, where it's a broken sound. I mean, that's a wonderful way of describing the way that the wind cuts across the sound of the bell coming across the wind and cuts into it, and then it comes back again like a new bell sounding. And incredible at getting that effect. I can't think of another poet that would notice precisely that.
Yeah, and it does cast his role as observer, as a poet ought to be to a degree. You are seeing this through his eyes because he does make it so viscerally real.
Yeah.
Mm. Would you like the mower?
Yes, please, yeah.
The mower stalled twice. Kneeling, I found a hedgehog jammed up against the blades. Killed. It had been in the long grass. I had seen it before and even fed it once. Now I had mauled its unobtrusive world, unmendably. Burial was no help. Next morning, I got up, and it did not. The first day after a death, the new absence is always the same. We should be careful. Of each other, we should be kind, while there is still time. I mean, the time, just the kind of reference there to time, at the end, just speaks so strongly to me of Hardy. Hardy never gets away from noticing the passing of time. Yeah. It's such a ever-present theme. And, I kind of came to Larkin through Obard. And when I was working on this, I kind of had Obard in my head. And I wasn't sure how to bring those in because I was thinking of afterwards and Obard together. And then when I looked through more Larkin poems, I came across the mower and it fits so well. But that sense of a kind of memento mori at every moment of the day because you notice time passing, that's amazing to me.
Yeah. That links to a Hardy poem, I don't know what you think, I think it's called Lying Awake at Night. And it's about the 3 or 4 o'clock insomnia and how things always seem so much worse. But before we got on to that, I wanted to talk to you, ask you, Arthur, about your both your reading of the mower, but also your setting of the mower, which seems to reflect your reading of the mower. With your setting, I noticed when you get those three parts of the mower beautifully, your setting seems to move through three parts, mm-hmm. and you put stress on unmendably, which I think is perfect. It's such a wonderful word. But you will also put a space after we should be careful, and I noticed you read it like that too. Whereas the poem doesn't do that. It says we should be careful of each other, we should be kind. But the way you put it in your setting works brilliantly.
It refers backwards.
Space, and then of each other, we should be kind. Because, of course, the thing about the narrator is that she's not careful. He stalls the mower twice. So he kills the hedgehog, he injures the hedgehog twice. And also, in a sense, it's the narrator's fault the hedgehog's there in the first place because he's been feeding.
Yeah, that's true.
He's
enticing the
mower, and it stalls. And then rather than just stop and think, oh, what's that? He does it.
Wonder how long the grass had to be. He must have let it grow quite long to be able to not see the hedgehog.
it's his emphasis on the word killed at the beginning of that line. Killed, you know.
Yeah.
It's like the narrator recognises their unwitting agency here in this creature's death. And it comes around that idea of we should be careful. Mm. That brilliantly in your setting with that space after we should be careful. And then you go into the more, you know, the grander ethical statement.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, it's terrifying talking to poetry experts having set some poems.
You make us read it. That's what setting poems to music does. It makes you look at them differently. And I absolutely love
it. It does. It's an interpretation. Yeah.
Thank you very much. I mean, the way that the mower reads to me, it kind of has this very initially at the start quite stark, quite matter of fact quality, and it just softens into the broader message at the end, and I hope that is reflected in my setting. The setting of the first answer is very kind of clipped and direct. It's not trying to do too much to exaggerate any emotion, and then just eventually towards the end it can soften and open up. And it's I'm pleased that you noticed unmendably. It's just a single word at the start, at the end of the second stanza, but it's so Hardy-esque, the negative where it need not be. Yeah. It's just strikes so hard.
I mean, this poem's been on the podcast quite a few times, and the interpretations and the kind of emphasis that people take from the poem is so varied. For such a short poem, you know, we had Francesca Gardner, postgraduate student, came to the conference and talked about the kind of mechanisation in the poem, and talked about the kind of the dual figure of the mower as the lawnmower and lark in the mower, and then obviously the link into the figure of death. And it was a really fascinating analysis of the poem in that way.
But that mechanisation reminds me, as you're talking about it now, of Tess on the threshing machine. In Tess the
Durbervilles,
that whole idea of this kind of Dickensian million hard times sort of idea, you know, that mechanisation can destroy human beings. It changed them into pace and unrestingness and having to do things without thinking, you know, turning off the mind and just feeding the machine.
Oh, and that's the same role that the trains play in Jude, that kind of change from country living, very static, very separate, to this different possibility, the different speed of life made possible by the train.
Tess is all about walking. Tess walks everywhere. It takes her ages, and she doesn't actually go very far, which is why she's always worried that somebody's going to know about her story. You know, it's such a tight, closed community, whereas you're right, in Jude, they take trains quite long distances. Mm. And they don't, and where they go, they're not known.
Yeah.
Well, they can start again, like complete strangers.
Yeah, they can be anonymous.
It's very striking that idea of modernity coming in. Having such an effect on life, on living things, whether it's hedgehogs or women or people or men or whoever. Yeah.
Yeah, because Hardy had that the narrative of the countryside and the city, and the difficulties all his difficulties seemed to come from the city. He seemed to see the countryside as the place where he needed to be and where he wrote, and that's where he grew up, where he wanted to be. And Larkin's a sort of suburban person, really. Quite lives a kind of world that Hardy didn't really exist for Hardy, that kind of life that Larkin lived, where you could, you know, where he lived in Hull, you know, near the university, you're not weighed down by the city, are you? You've got big avenues, big trees, and Newland Park and all that kind of stuff.
Such a long time.
Yeah, Pearson Park. And being able to get on your bike and go out to the East Riding, out to the countryside and out to the estuary. And I think that gives Larkin quite a very different sense of place to Hardy, just a different relationship between the sort of town and the countryside. It's less polarised, I think, in Larkin.
I mean, it's curious that Hardy's memento, like consciousness of death, is all contextualised with nature. Larkin's is in a hungover, dark bedroom. You know, the kind of the scope is different. I mean, I know those two poems aren't exact sisters, but in O'Bard, the domestic setting is really noticeable. You know, at the end when he talks about postmen like doctors go street to street or door to door. And just the I love the description.
And the wardrobe is a kind of...
And just that tiny crack of light between the curtains. I mean, it's a very insular... narrative, whereas Hardy's in his garden looking at nature and the stars and the kind of extrapolating that way.
But I was trying to find a quote where there's Hardy's little poem Lying Awake, which I don't know whether you know,
I don't know that. You mentioned it earlier, I've written it down.
It's only short. It's called Lying Awake. You, morning tide star, now are steady eyed over the east. I know it as if I saw you. You, beeches, engrave on the sky your thin twigs, even the least. Had I paper and pencil, I'd draw you. You, meadow, are white with your counterpane cover of dew. I see it as if I were there. You, churchyard, are lightning faint from the shade of the yew, the names creeping out everywhere. I mean, it's that awareness of mortality that seems to come to both narrators, the Hardian one and the Larkin one, at 3 or 4 in the morning or whatever it is, you know.
I find it both comforting and terrifying at the same time. Their description of or consciousness of mortality, I mean, especially thinking of O'Bard and the two Hardy ones we just discussed, it's both kind of reassuring and, in my sense, optimistic, because it's kind of, if you look at the other side of it, it's looking at how great life is. But it's also, if you take it on a surface reading, it is still bleak. It's still about death.
Yeah. Well, it's like a little Father Time in Jude saying, well, I'd really enjoy the flower if I wasn't aware that they were going to die soon. Mm. And, you know, it can shade into a kind of mawkishness that stops you enjoying. But it is that preciousness, the preciousness of life and the sense of it fading.
And I suppose noticing the ephemera, everything's changing all the time, and being at one with that, I suppose, is the battle that they both talk about.
I mean, but Larkin had such a fear of death, didn't he? That Hardy doesn't seem to have that fear in the way that Larkin had this absolute terror of death.
Hardy, as a lot of Victorians, were pretty used to it. It was very much a fact of life. Maybe not so much so for the time that Larkin was living in.
Yeah, I think so.
I just said death becomes much more frightening because we're so much more separated from it. I mean, it was commonplace for people at Hardy's time to see dead people all the time, and you would nurse your elderly parents and relatives through, and you lost children all the time. And
yeah, because Emma died in Hardy's arms.
He was downstairs. Right? I think the story goes, I mean, this is Claire Tomlin's, from Claire Tomlin's biography. The Dolly, the maid, came down to Hardy's study and said, I think you might want to go upstairs. I'm not sure if Emma's pretty poorly. And he told the maid to straighten her collar. That was his first reaction. But no, and then he did go upstairs and you know, was shocked to find her. I mean, his response to Emma's death is—it's so interesting and it's so curious, and no one quite agrees on a narrative that comes out of it. I mean, the poems of 1912 to 1913 are undoubtedly an incredible outpouring of grief, nostalgic love. They, when he harks back to their courtship, slight grains of bitterness, acknowledgement of some guilt. But they're not, they're just not straightforward. I mean, this is what drew me to them, to set them in the first place, is trying to represent all of those complex emotions that are happening at the same time. I feel like that's a natural thing for music to do. So they give you that scope. But their role within how he's seen, how his first marriage is categorized, is very difficult to place, because I would argue that even by Victorian standards, he's not a good husband. They have this whirlwind courtship, and you know, Hardy's very good at falling in love and enjoys falling in love. The domestic day-to-day of being a relationship, I think he's not so hot on, you know, what's for dinner and all that. They grow apart so severely, and for the last 10 years of Emma's life, they lead pretty much separate lives. She lives in an attic room upstairs, where she paints and draws and writes, and Hardy just kind of is very separate. Now, once she dies, there's a sudden outpouring of these poems. Now, whether they are truly a reversal and like an understanding of I've let this marriage kind of dwindle and fade and I wish I hadn't, I don't fully buy that narrative at all. But, you know, the poems themselves are definitely elegiac. And, you know, from my perspective, without I am always conscious of the composer dipping too much into meaning in poems. But so I want to keep some of the ambiguity there. But I am seeing it as elegies for Emma. From my perspective, I want to try and put across some of the Emma's narrative and Emma's perspective on their relationship. So they're my inclination in that set of compositions is to think about Emma's perspective more than Hardy, because I think we've said this before when we're just meeting up, the poems in some ways are more about him than they are about her.
I thought that the short poem, like a lot of these poems are new to me, a circular, I thought was quite Larkin-esque, in that, you know, the way the sort of modern kind of the modern world intrudes on his grief, you know, those designs of the clothes and the thing that's just come through the door and you don't want to see. And it's again very like realistic. Anybody could understand what that feels like. To have something just appear in your house that you didn't invite there, something, you know, whether it's a newspaper or just a circular letter, a magazine or something, that absolutely knocks you for six because it reminds you the person you've lost. And that's such a like a psychologically real state of what it is actually like to grieve. I like the list in there, the figure blouses, gowns for tea. It reminds me of something like Here, you know, where it looks at those items for sale and then actually puts it into its context. It really stood out for me as a really, like, I wouldn't have put it into as a Hardy poem at all.
We have Larkin's line about the busy rented world, you know, that the busy rented world will carry on regardless of what any individual at any one time within that busy rented world may be feeling or going through or suffering, or you know, the, as you were saying, Arthur, the postman will deliver to each door.
There's
a kind of strange mundanity about life going on when one is fixed in grief, you know, when one has been shocked by grief.
And it's that hole that's left in the individual that is not reflected in the world. And they pick up on that. I mean, I suppose cruelty, really, from the individual's perspective, that it's basically a world that doesn't care, but to you, that's the hole that's left. I've just noticed that they talk about clothes quite a lot as well. I was reading Skin earlier, and there's that list of clothes in there as well, when you mentioned the Hardy list of clothes, which I'd never really noticed before. I mean, maybe it's just a freak of those couple, but... Larkin's relationship with, when he talks about relationships in his poetry, are there similarities there? I mean, we talked earlier about neutral tones, I think before we were recording. What's the equivalent in Larkin's output?
We were talking about a poem called No Road.
Oh, that was it, yeah.
Which is about the end of his relationship with Ruth Bowman. It's only a short one, and it does sit really nicely alongside Neutral Tones, actually. I don't know if you can get a copy up there.
Oh, yeah, I've got it here.
Just find... So one thing I think that sets Larkin and Hardy apart is that Larkin didn't have that kind of bereavement in the way that Hardy experienced. He'd never lost a loved one in the same way. He lost his father when he was 25, which obviously had a huge impact on him. But all his girlfriends outlived him. He'd spent so much of his life looking after his mother, and Eva was so elderly and infirm. By the time she passed away, it was quite a release for him. So I feel like the life experiences are so different in that respect. You know, Larkin never had that huge romantic loss and grief that Hardy, you know, felt for when he lost Emma, whatever the difficulties were. And actually, when you lose someone you've had a difficult relationship with, that's often harder, isn't it?
Yeah. You were saying, Arthur, that you thought Hardy wasn't a very good husband by anybody's standards. And then you've said, Lynn, that Larkin wasn't particularly successful in relationships. They were writers. Writers are anybody who is really, really committed to what they do. Whether it's writing poetry, writing books, writing music. Writers are very difficult to live with if you're not a writer yourself.
It's hard.
And for Emma, certainly, again, not to be too biographical about it, she very much encouraged him in his writing, and she was the kind of driving force behind him giving up architecture to write a novel, even though it meant they could marry for 4 years, by which time she was by Victorian standards, you know, sort of, you know, getting on a bit, shall we say. She's so vibrant and present in the early novels, I think, in Desperate Remedies as much as in Perfectly Wise. But Desperate Remedies, the central character there is absolutely Emma all the way through the description. Mm. The same coloured hair, the same coloured eyes, the same vivacity. And she supported him hugely. And then when he got famous, he basically dumped. And he was being courted and feted by Lady Jeune and their literary salons that he was invited to. And Emma felt really left out and ignored. And then, of course, he was writing against the clock. Mm. You know, writing, he was getting commissions for novels that he hadn't even barely started. And they wanted the next instalment and the next instalment on a regular basis. Mm. So writing against the clock all the time. He just wasn't available to her for a lot of their life. They had their holidays, their long European holidays together.
But it's an abandonment. I mean, she must have felt quite abandoned because she was so involved in the editing process in the early parts. And it was such a big part of their courtship was reading and talking about writing. And you can really see the seed of bitterness being there. And I just don't think Hardy did anything to arrest that. And that's probably where I come down on him a little bit hard, in that, you know, if he's that caring about hedgehogs, perhaps he could extend that to his wife.
And I mean that after the publication of you know, the letters and the biography, Andrew Merchant's biography, and a lot of people kind of looked at Larkin, and people still do look at him as a misogynist. And
this is the problem reading the life
exactly,
into
the
time, that it blinds you to the. I mean, the art is either brilliant or it isn't brilliant.
Yeah, and I mean, James Booth kind of reset the argument and said, well, this is more like what you were saying, Jane, that actually being married to an artist, to a writer, is immensely difficult. And Larkin just knew it wouldn't work. It just would not work. So, you know, and that's...
No. And he writes about that, doesn't he? Well, this poem writes about love, and he says, "Oh God, imagine having to be selfless. You know, you do for one person. It's unimaginable." And he says, "Oh, it just won't work for me. You know, it's just going to work." And of course, that abandonment that you say, Arthur, which I think is true, that Emma must have felt, leads her to make ridiculous claims, which estranges them even more. Like, "Oh, he got all his ideas from me." You know, it's one of those things that I'm sure a lot of writers really fear somebody else saying, well, actually, he didn't write that, I wrote it. You know, that was my, those are all my ideas.
It just feels like they're toxic because their responses to each other's insecurities exacerbate the problem. I mean, I know we're doing exactly what you're cautioning against, getting too much into the bio, but their story is fascinating because it just seems like the rift will only grow because everything that causes the rift causes further antagonism on the other side.
One never knows, do one?
You got the world in a joke.
Yeah, but where's the stopper?
And you got nothing to do.
I also wanted to point to, you know, Larkin's Oxford Book of 20th Century Verse, which as you know, features Hardy. Got slightly more pages than anybody else. What Larkin interestingly includes with Hardy are some of the early Shooter Hymn sonnets, which seem to me, you know, much more tonally, much more like neutral tones than No Road.
Did Larkin's anthology kind of aid Hardy's reception? He was particularly unpopular before that, right? I mean, I'm not saying that's the only thing. Is that right?
Well, he was regarded as old-fashioned and backward-looking. Mm. And as Larkin says, the Vogue was more for Yeats and Dylan Thomas, which more mystical in a way. And, you know, you will know, and your listeners will know that it was Hardy that, as you said earlier, I think, Lynn, Hardy gave him permission to write about ordinary life and ordinary things and mundane quotidian events rather than have to import mystery and mysticism and everything else, high blown language. But I think along with a couple of critics that he actually didn't do as much of a service to Hardy as he thought he did, because he kind of preserves Hardy in aspic really, rather than recognising how incredibly experimental he is, both in the way that he uses archaic Victorian language, but he'll stick it in the middle of a sentence with more modern words. You know, he mixes it all up and you can see him a bit born before his time, really. He's not quite got, because of the ages when he's writing poems, he's not growing up in that make it new era, but he's very transitional. Auden thought he was a transitional poet, and Auden almost, he didn't think he could write the kind of poems that he wrote if he hadn't read Hardy. You know, it was Hardy that got him over, you know, into the 20th century.
I think writing this, putting this anthology together was a pretty horrible experience for Larkin and a pretty thankless job in the end. I mean, it's very much a double-edged sword, isn't it, being given this job to do? Yeah. And I think he upset a lot of people with his choices.
So did he not enjoy it?
Well, it was Yeats who'd done the one before, so Larkin took over from Yeats, so you know there was bound to be a bit of sideswiping, I think.
I'll read No Road then. No Road. Since we agreed to let the road between us fall to disuse, and bricked our gates up, planted trees to screen us, and turned all times eroding agents loose, silence and space and strangers, our neglect has not had much effect. Leaves drift unswept, perhaps grass creeps unmown, no other change. So clear it stands, so little overgrown. Walking that way tonight would not seem strange, and still would be allowed. A little longer, and time would be the stronger. Drafting a world where no such road will run from you to me, to watch that world come up like a cold sun. Rewarding others is my liberty. Not to prevent it is my will's fulfilment. Willing it, my ailment.
I don't know about you, but I have a real problem trying to get my head around the meaning of those last two lines.
Yeah, so he wants to separate them, doesn't he, themselves, and the narrator does not want that road to exist anymore between them. He doesn't want that backwards and forwards between them anymore. He wants the relationship to end. To watch that world come up like a cold sun, rewarding others is my liberty. So that would cause him, give him freedom, wouldn't it? That's why he needs that to finish this relationship. Yeah. Not to prevent it is my... It's so hard with Larkin, isn't
it? Not to prevent
it. Double negative.
It's my will's problem.
Yeah.
it's almost double negative.
So I want to not prevent it. I want to make it happen. That's my fulfillment.
Yeah.
But willing it, it makes him... I presume that wanting it also makes it's an ailment. It's a sickness. He shouldn't want them to separate, I think. Yeah. There's a guilt there. Yeah.
Yeah, and you shouldn't want to become the time and the distance between yeah. them to make yeah. them indifferent to one another.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you don't know in that second stanza whether he's actually talking about an actual meeting, you know, whether he is going to go past her house or whatever. Yeah. But it's more metaphorical, isn't it? It's more to do with thinking about the person, the beloved that he's no longer with, and maybe allowing his memory yeah. to rekindle her image, and maybe even, you know, yeah. ringing her up and saying, yeah. how about it? You know, and he says, walking that way tonight would not seem strange and still would be allowed. So he knows he would probably say yes. He would probably say yes.
How old was Larkin when he wrote this? Is he a younger man?
28.
Yeah, and it's notable. I mean, it does have a striking resemblance to Neutral Tones. And I wonder if it's just that slightly more naive response to love. They're so heightened. It's such a visceral, strong reaction.
Yeah.
It's interesting that he was kind of young in the same way that Hardy's relatively young when he writes Neutral Tones.
I really like the strength of that extended metaphor. It works so well. You know, the idea that when you separate, you put up barriers, you know, you plant the trees, you go out of your way, don't you? And you think, right, I'll cross your name out of my phone book and I'll not go around and all that sort of stuff. And then also the natural things take over, you know, the leaves start to drift, it starts to get overgrown. You know, you gradually, naturally get used to being apart. But that road's still there, that connection is still there. It really resonates very truly to me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, turned all time's eroding agents loose, the things that erode that memory, silence and space and strangers.
Yeah, and that line, like you said, walking that way tonight would not seem strange and still would be allowed. So it's almost like kind of flirt, you know, the flirtation is still there. I could still go back. Because that's kind of like a, not really, shouldn't really be allowed, should it? You're supposed to brick it up. This is what we do humans, don't we?
That's why you break it up, so you can't see the road anymore. It's kind of, it does really work.
It works so well. It's a kind of portrait of two people that, or at least one person who really thinks there's lots of good reasons why he should separate from that other person. And yet there's still a very strong,
I suppose it's way one step away from the drunk phone call. Don't let me complete
it, and it would still be allowed. You could still do the drunk phone call.
Exactly. Yeah. Should I read Neutral Tones?
Yeah.
We stood by a pond that winter day, and the sun was white as though chidden of God, and a few leaves lay on the starving sod. They had fallen from an ash and were grey. Your eyes on me were as eyes that rove over tedious riddles of years ago. And some words played between us to and fro, on which we lost the more by our love. The smile on your mouth was the deadest thing, alive enough to have strength to die, and a grin of bitterness swept thereby, like an ominous bird a wing. Since then, keen lessons that love deceives, and rings with wrong have shaped to me your face, and the God-cursed sun, and a tree, and a pond edged with greyish leaves.
When I was an English teacher, this got put on the syllabus a few times for GCSE, and I've got it kind of etched in my head, you know, underlining chidden of God and joining it up with God cursed son and things like that. The imagery is very, very immediate, even for youngsters that, you know, might struggle with more old fashioned language.
Thought the starving sod was a reference to a peasant.
Seriously. There's an anger there. I mean, or a bitterness rather. It feels it's not the most generous of spirit perspective.
We've met. We're splitting up. We're breaking up. We're each trying to make our conversation with one another neutral. And that's all echoed in, as you say, Lynn. The neutral colours, the grey and the God cursed sun and. Ash. The whole landscape is colourless. There's no emotion there. There's no emotional colour in the landscape and no emotional colour in their tired, tedious lack of conversation. You know, a few words passed. And again, forgive me, but Arthur, but you stumbled over that line and I'm surprised because again, you've got that awkwardness in the middle. What is it? A few words passed between us on which lost the more by our love. That's such a difficult line, and whether your students found that, Lynn, on which lost the more by our love, what does that mean? I mean, you kind of know what it means. The words that we spoke between us kind of showed up how little in love we were at that point. You know, our love was eroded even more by the few words that passed between us. But it's a really difficult line, and it might be, again, of those last two or three lines in the Larkin wrestling language into meaning. You know, it's like, this is a really difficult thing to say, and that's mirrored in the difficulty and intractability of the language in both of those two poems.
It's curious.
Yeah, the smile on your mouth. I like that. The detachment of that.
Not your smile.
Smile on your mouth.
Yeah.
No, it's just a smile. It's a horrifying image.
Mm. And that's that. I mean, that's my favourite line in that. When we get to the second half of that poem, the smile on your mouth was the deadest thing, alive enough to have strength to die.
Yeah,
it's an amazing
like
image.
The smile you used to give me. Mm.
Yeah.
It reminds me of the smile you used to give me, but no, you don't mean it. Yeah.
I do find that second stanza really difficult to get my lips around. But
it is really hard. Yeah.
Which, curious, from a musical perspective, those kind of lines, on which lost the more by our love. It has such a lot of texture to it that it feels really exciting to set. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if Lutty the singer will agree with me, but they're the lines that I feel more able to get stuck into, because you've got texture and percussive moments, and you can frame them and highlight them in a way that when I read it, I just end up stumbling. But in music, you can exaggerate those things. There is a setting of this by Nicholas Moore from the 60s, again with guitar, and I really like it. It's a very different approach than I would take, but it's an interesting idea, the way that he goes about it.
Is Hardy sort of widely set to music?
Massively. I mean, that's kind of why we've started on this project, because he's probably one of the most set English poets that there is. Maybe Shakespeare, but of the same type. It's very hard to think of anyone that's set more. I mean, Finzi set over 50 of his poems. Britain set a whole heap. It's just such a huge part of English art song. Well, and beyond. And one of the things we've done, as I said before, we've got these two new song cycles that set Hardy and Larkin. We've also got a suite of new arrangements of songs from across 1923 to 2023. And we've been trying to dig out some lost settings. So some of them are really famous ones by Finzi in Britain, but we've got some other ones by Imogen Holst, Robin Milford, Ivor Gurney, that were never published in their lifetimes. There's an Australian writer called Henry Handel Richardson. She's Ethel Florence Richardson, but went by the pen name Henry Handel. She wrote a song setting Hardy, and that's in our collection as well. So we've tried to slightly reappraise the canon, because Britain, Finzi, Bax, they are done all the time, and they're beautiful and they're wonderful and they're very important to me and to everyone who loves music. But having these slightly other interpretations and broadening the canon a little bit is important. And it's just fun to have some new rep from across those 100 years.
You make a shout out to Jim's book.
Yeah, Astonishing the Brickwork by Jim Warren. Yes. I don't know if you've come across that, Arthur.
Well, only through the Society. I have been meaning to get a copy.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Just lovely to read and dip into and learn so much about every genre of musician has covered a Larkin poem from around the world, and it's just fascinating, really fascinating.
I had a theory. Nobody agrees with me on this one, but you know the Stranglers song, Walking on the Beaches, looking at the people?
Yeah.
That reminds me so much of a Hardy poem.
Which
when
one?
When we came to the beaches. I don't know the title. I'll have to look it up and tell you. But
Oh, definitely let me know.
It's from the Dynasts, and it's I think it's from the Dynasts, and it's something like the Sergeant Major song, or I wish I could remember it now, but he rhymes peaches and beaches.
Oh, amazing.
Anybody else who rhymes peaches and beaches apart from the Stranglers. and then when you read it through, they talk about being on leave in Weymouth. They're on furlough, or whatever it was called.
Yeah.
They're out for the day, these soldiers are out for the day, and they're eyeing up all the women. And then suddenly they hear the call that they've got to go back to barracks, and they're scrambling to get back to the barracks. And in the Hardys, in the Stranglers, it's the Sharabang's leaving. We've got to get back on the Sharabang.
Oh, brilliant.
That's great. You know what I
mean? That's so good. I was looking back through some of the old copies of About Larking. So I know that a couple of years ago, the Larking and Hardy Society did a joint conference down in Dorchester, 2019 it was. And Philip Pullen went down and gave a talk about Larking going down to Hardy's Wessex. And it was reprinted in About Larking from that year. And what I really liked about it was that Larking is just a proper fan of Hardy, and I kind of really, I'm the same when I go up to Hull, and I like to go and wander around all the places where Larking was and all the kind of places I've made people go with me because of Philip Larking. And there's a lovely account where they visited the local museums, Hardy's birthplace, obviously Stinsford, Mellstock Churchyard. And he and Ruth Bowman, and Ruth was the person that he'd separated from after, when he'd written No Road. They'd walked together 10 miles. And I just thought I'd just read Ruth's account of that holiday, if you don't mind, because it makes me see the humanity of Larking, really. Between Christmas and the New Year at the end of 1948, we explored the Hardy country, Hardy being a writer for whom we both had the deepest admiration. The weather was, as you might say, seasonable, but Philip said this was much more of a suitable time of year to evoke Hardy than summertime with its crowds of tourists. There were certainly none of them. After we had worshipped at the shrine of Max Gate and drunk in all the Hardy landmarks around Dorchester, Philip expressed a great desire to walk from Dorchester to Weymouth. So we set off on a bright, cold December morning, feeling romantically like two Hardy characters trudging from Casterbridge to Budmouth. I suppose we expected to travel a country highway. At any rate, we were outraged to find ourselves on a busy main road flanked by nasty garages and ribbon development houses. It was the dreariest walk imaginable, and the weather showed ominous change, but we set our teeth and arrived at Weymouth in driving rain and in a gale which dashed the waves over the seafront and had us drenched to the skin. To reward ourselves, we stayed at a very fine hotel full of 18th century splendour as to decor, and with a tariff to match.
That's great.
How lovely to walk 10 miles with Philip Larking in the drizzle.
Thank you so much to Jane and Arthur for giving their time so generously. Please have a look at Arthur's website, arthurkeegan.co.uk, which has all the links to his current and future projects and where you can hear his settings of Hardy and Larking. Just a reminder that we have now confirmed a date with the University of Hull for the 2024 Philip Larking Society Conference, which will be taking the 50th anniversary of High Windows as its starting point. This conference will have a wide focus and will feature artists, musicians and creative contributions, as well as academic papers. There will also be plenty of opportunities to chat and just enjoy reading and discussing Larking. The dates are the 14th to the 15th of March 2024. Registration will open later this year, so please keep the date free. And if you're interested in being a speaker, then please get in touch. Another date for your diary? On Saturday, the 16th of September at 5 o'clock in the evening, we will be hosting an online event that you won't want to miss. We're very excited that our Honorary Vice President and Literary Advisor, Andrew Motion, will be joined by novelist and poet Blake Morrison to discuss Motion's new memoir, Sleeping on Islands. Larking will certainly feature. It's free to attend and tickets will be available via Eventbrite in the next month. If you're interested in getting more involved with the PLS in general, then we'd love to hear from you. We're always very pleased to hear from people that would like to help out with social events, education, social media, the conference, website support and more. And of course, listening to the podcast, tweeting your thoughts, rating and reviewing are fantastic ways of supporting us to promote the appreciation of all things Larking. Please keep listening for Arthur's setting of the Mower, from Elegies to Tom, with mezzo-soprano Lottie Betts-Dean and the Ligeti Quartet.
Thank you.
This podcast was produced by me, Lynn Lockwood, and Gavin Hogg, and the music was The Horns of the Morning by The Mechanicals Band. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for future topics, then please, as ever, do get in touch.
Of the morning are blowing, are shining. The meadow is wet with the coldest of dew. The dawn reassembles with a clash of